and I'm recording. Welcome to Radio Live Green Smart and to our Building Green discussion brought to you in association with István Newell of Kayasol Green Building Solutions. You're welcome to phone in on mobile number in South Africa 27 082 651 4273. I'll repeat that. South Africa 27 082 651 4273, or you can Skype on emmanuel.fun.der.meulen. I'll spell that. Echo Mike Alpha, N for Nelly, U for Ultra, Echo L for Lima, .van.der.meulen, and phone in anytime with questions about Building Green. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and before we start, a little bit about Radio Live Green Smart. It's a forum to discuss green living, eco-friendly living, and importantly, a forum to discuss where you see any disrespect for the environment firsthand. Bring such disrespect to us, we'll assist to expose such environmental disrespect. Use contact us to send the details of the disrespect. Please provide comprehensive information so it makes it easy for us to follow up. Now, a small introduction to the discussion. What is green building? Sustainable or green building design and construction is about wisely using resources to create high quality, healthier and energy efficient homes and commercial buildings. A green building is more than the sum of its parts. Its process and impact also matters. Green design is about finding balance between high quality construction and low environmental impact. A lighter footprint means a longer lasting planet, which is a win for the builder, for the client, and for the environment. Green building is a goal and a process. Viewing sustainable building as a process is important because green building success isn't just a matter of building with green materials. Green building combines both materials and processes to maximize efficiency, durability, savings. The savings is an important part, and then also a solid return on investment. We'll now talk to István Newell from Kayasol Green Building Solutions. Hello, István. Just before we start, please introduce yourself and Kayasol to our listeners.
Good evening, Emmanuel. Thank you for having me here tonight. It's an honor to be at your newly created radio show. Thank you.
You're welcome, István.
Yeah, Kayasol was founded in 2010. It derived from a industrial automation company. The two founding fathers, if you can call it that way, are my two colleagues, Jonathan and Franz. Since then, it's been a long journey working together with many, many companies, all related to green living, green building, greenhouses, whatsoever. I'm a studied engineer in mechanical engineering. Well, it's actually a mix of mechanical engineering and electrical engineering. And I came here about 10 years ago to South Africa. I studied in Germany and decided to live in South Africa. And 1 year after founding Kayasol, I joined the team. And with me, I brought the knowledge for the underfloor heating, for the entire thermal heating systems.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. Very interesting introduction, István. Okay, so let's go to the next topic. What is hydronics underfloor heating? Can you elaborate on what that is?
Many people might know how electrical underfloor heating works. That's when wires get laid into the screed. Similar is the hydronic underfloor heating, only we don't lay wires, we lay pipes, actual water pipes. It's a multi-layer PEX pipe, a plastic pipe. And in there we circulate warm water. That heat, which is carried by the warm water, is then transferred into the screed, and the screed transfers it into your room, essentially heating the structure of the building. Now, in the screed, you'll find during the installation, you can see it afterwards, it's hidden away. you'll find a whole spider web of piping, but everything's without pipe crossings. The pipe is laid at a spacing of about 100 millimeters, so every 100 millimeters in your ground structure, you will find pipe with water circulating in it. And that is done in such a way because the more area is covered in a building, the more heating surface you got, the better the efficiency of the entire system. In the house, depending on the size of the house, you'll have, we call it manifolds. The flow, we have a following problem. The length of the pipe is limited. We can only have a maximum length of 100 meters, 100 meters per circuit. Now, in a big house, you'll have many, many circuits. It can be 20, 30 circuits easily. So per circuit, we can cover 10 square meters. And if your room is, for instance, 30 square meters, then you'll need 3 circuits. And in that 30 square meter room, you'll then have 300 meters of pipe. So per square meter, we lay out 10 meters of pipe. The house is then separated into different zones. So each room then has a separate thermostat, and each room can be controlled separately.
Okay, thank you, István. Let me just make sure I understood. Is the PEX pipe plastic?
Yes, it is a plastic, so it can be bent very easily, okay. And it is slightly less efficient than copper. Okay. Copper is a very good conductor, but if you think about how much pipe is in the floor, it's kilometers per house, then the copper would work out very expensive to lay, and the PEX pipe in comparison is very cost effective.
Okay.
But yes, you have a little bit less heating efficiency.
Okay. Is that pipe reinforced at all?
The pipe has got an aluminium layer inside. The very inside of the pipe is plastic. That's where the water comes in contact with the pipe. It's very smooth, so the friction is very low, created by the pipe. Then you have a layer of aluminium, which gives it stability. It also makes it, you can afterwards find the pipe with a pipe finder in the floor in case you want to drill somewhere. And another reason for that, we'll talk about it a little bit later. And that aluminium inside the pipe is also a vapor barrier, because we don't want air to infiltrate into that closed water system, because air and water causes rust on metal parts.
Okay.
And to avoid all that, the pipe has got an aluminium layer inside to seal it off, pretty much.
Okay. I'm very happy that an expert will lay it. I wouldn't know how to do that.
It is not that complicated.
Okay. István, thank you for that. Let's move on to the next one. Now, how does the hydronics compare to electrical underfloor heating?
The electrical underfloor heating is very responsive. So you switch it on and half an hour later you can feel the floor is warm already. It is a little bit different here with the hydronic underfloor heating system, because we have a much thicker screed layer on top, so there's a bit more matter to heat through first, until the temperature reaches the floor and until the floor can heat the entire space. So that is the first thing one needs to have in mind, that it's a bit slower. So it takes a couple of hours after you switch it on, it takes a couple of hours that the space gets warm. But the intention is here not to switch it on and off on demand, the intention is here to keep it running. It will regulate and control itself. It will switch the room off if the room reaches temperature, or switch it on once the temperature is too low. So it's intelligent. You don't need to interfere as a user. There's a whole logic behind it to control all that. You set your temperatures once and that's pretty much it. Also, it's a bit more complex than electrical underfloor heating. With electrical underfloor heating, you have a electrical connection on the wall, and the installer wires the wire web to it, and then you have a thermostat which switches it on or off. Here you have a heat source. This can be different things to create that heat, which is then transferred into the water. You need much more space for the entire equipment. You have pumps and valves and an entire DB for the control. So it's a bit more of an effort, and one needs to know what is happening and what needs to happen on site not to lose it, basically. Different heat sources can, for instance, be a heat pump, which is the most popular method of heating the water which circulates in the floor. The heat pump, the advantage of a heat pump is it can run at any time as long as there's electricity. Where the electricity comes from, whether it's Eskom or you produce it yourself, that doesn't matter. If there's electricity, the heat pump runs. Another method of heating it is solar panels on the roof. So typically you would have a tank. The tank is connected to a couple of panels on the roof, and during the day a pump will circulate the water from the tank up into the panels and then back into the tank. And from there the water then gets distributed into the entire house. Now, this advantage of this method is that heat generation only happens during the day when the sun is shining, but most of the heating happens at night. And in order to avoid the tank cooling down, you'll have to have a couple of tanks and lots of panels to heat those tanks. That's 2,000, 3,000 liters. And then at night you can use those tanks like a heat battery, and you just draw the heat out until the next morning when they heat up again. Another method would be gas, which is a very expensive. It's still cheaper than electrical heating, but it's expensive compared to the other methods. It's a gas boiler which then circulates, heats the water which circulates through it, and that way you can also heat. And another method would be a fireplace. That is a special one with the built-in heat exchanger where the flue gases exit. So when you make a fire in the lounge, for instance, you enjoy your fire in the lounge, and at the same time water is circulated through the heat exchanger and then goes back to the tank, and from there it gets distributed in the house. So basically you have a warm lounge through your fireplace, but at the same time you're heating the bedroom and the bathroom on the other side of the house. That is how this system works. An advantage of hydronic underfloor heating is also that you can combine sources. You can have a heat pump that covers the heating at night via electricity, and you can have solar which heats the tank during the day when the sun is out. So you can those systems assist each other and therefore reducing the electrical demand even more. The initial investment of such a system is much higher, but the running costs to heat the house are so much lower than electrical underfloor heating. So you can say it's about a fifth of a comparable electrical underfloor heating system, which means with the electrical consumption of a geyser, you could heat 200 square meters. And that's when the heat pump is running flat out a very cold day.
Okay, so out of all these heat sources for hydronics, would you say that the heat pump is probably the easier and least expensive mechanism?
It is the easiest, yes. It costs a bit more than a fireplace, for instance, if you use a fireplace for heating, or a gas unit. But then again, with a fireplace, you need to put wood in there and keep it running.
Yeah.
You can't just put one batch in and forget about it. You need to keep it running.
Okay.
While with the heat pump, switches on, there's no mess, no fuss. It always works. It's a very reliable unit.
Okay. And also, the house that we developed, by using the heat pump, we could also cool the house. So all year round, through the hydronics, in the winter we have a heat source that will warm up the house to a comfortable temperature, and then in summer we could then cool the house down as well. And that's what the heat pump will that's what the heat pump will give us?
Yeah, that's correct. Those units which can cool as well are a bit more expensive.
Okay.
But generally, it is possible to cool the house through, whether it's the floor or walls or ceiling, doesn't matter.
Okay.
But yes, that's correct.
Okay. Moving on then, the general requirements for hydronics. Can you just cover those for us? What does it all entail?
What I always recommend my clients who inquire about underflow heating, first think about the building, think about the efficiency of the building, and then look into alternative heating or cooling methods. And that starts with very easy things like insulating the building shell, such as double glazing, for instance. Double glazing can prevent the heat from going out in winter. So you keep the heat inside. In summer, it keeps the heat outside. Those double glazed windows generally are more are tighter than single glazing. There's no draft. Also, they shield the noise. That is a very big advantage of double glazed windows, that the noise levels drop significantly.
Yeah.
So yeah, one method would be double glazing. Then insulate the roof. So there's if you don't insulate your roof or your ceiling, then you're gonna lose all your heat. Might as well not heat, with other words.
Okay.
So the roof must be insulated. Then if you are willing to invest that additional money, then also insulate the walls. So if you have your double walls with a cavity, there are methods to insulate that cavity with insulation. That also reduces the heat flow in winter than the heat flow from the inside to the outside, because it gets stuck pretty much in the middle.
Yeah, in the property that we developed, we did exactly that by adding the two layers and the cavity, and then we use lambda board in the cavity, which, as you say, then insulated both from the inside and from the outside, making the wall quite a bit wider than regular double walls.
Another method would be there's those it's like granules which can be poured into those cavities, and they also work quite nicely.
Okay.
Then something that comes with the underfloor heating is the floor insulation. So basically, the different layers of a underfloor heated floor would be, if you take your slab, then at first we install a vapor barrier. It's just a plastic, your USB plastic, to prevent moisture from the underside to get through to the flow heating system, because humidity is an additional heat carrier, so it will carry the heat away from the floor. On top of that plastic, we put high density polystyrene. That's a special polystyrene that is meant to go onto floors. The thickness of that polystyrene is around about 50 millimeters on ground floors. On upper floors, you can reduce it to 25 millimeters, for instance, or 30 millimeters. And on top of that polystyrene, we then put our, we call it the knobbed panel. That panel has two functions. Firstly, also another vapor barrier to prevent moisture. And secondly, you have to imagine it like a panel which is interlinked with the next neighbor, like Lego. And through that, we create like a carpet in which we lay the pipe. So we ensure that the pipe is always at the same spacing. It looks neat and straight and proper. The screed will be at a thickness of about 70-80 millimeters. So that's much thicker than for normal screeds or electric underfloor heating screeds. It is poured straight on top of that entire construction underneath, enclosing the pipe inside. The 70 millimeters basically create a block of matter, which then also stores lots of heat in case the heat pump switches off, or if there's a power outage, you won't even notice that it's getting colder, because there's so much heat, like a battery. There's so much heat stored in the screed. And yeah, on top of this grid, there's your final floor covering, your tiles, thin carpet, wooden floor if you want, ideally tiles, because they also conduct heat very well, just like they conduct heat away from your foot when they are cold, they conduct heat from underneath as well, okay. To the upper side. But also, yes, carpet also works if it's not too thick. Another thing which many architects seem to forget when they design or when they inquire about underfloor heating systems is a dedicated room for all the equipment. That can be a small room, 2 meters by 3 meters, for instance. It's usually big enough where all the equipment can be installed. And from there, we basically supply the floor with the required water. And also in there, we put the DB and the tank and whatever is required in order to operate the entire system. Duration of the installation is round about, we can install about 100 to 150 square meters per week, just for the floor. And then the utility room, so the rest of the installation is about another 2 weeks, roughly. During the installation, no one can be on site. No other tradespersons can be walking around because it's a very clean job. It's almost like in a hospital. It's sterile. So we come, before we start, we vacuum the whole place. We clean because we don't want any stones or dirt to penetrate the pipe, and then we might have a leakage. Although leakages can be fixed afterwards, but yeah, it's better to avoid it from the beginning.
Okay, that sounds very interesting, but again, highly specialized. Istvan, just on the note of the installation and the time it takes, does that mean also that if it should be dust-free, that by now the windows are in, the ceiling is in, and that you've got the shell is completely built by now?
Yes, that means exactly that, and that would make me very happy if it always happens on all sides. Yes, ideally windows, everything closed, doors are in. If it's not possible to put the windows in, then those openings must be closed with plastic, so that wind and dirt and rain and whatever cannot blow through.
Okay, thank you for the interesting information. Right, so let's look at, you already mentioned the different floor covering. Can you just recap on the different floor coverings used with Hydronics?
Yes, many people nowadays also go for a polished screed, which I didn't mention earlier. So polished screed and tiles are ideal for underfloor heating because they conduct heat very well, and that's what we want. We want to conduct the heat away from the pipe, which is about 60 millimeters below. We want to conduct that heat away to the inside of the room, and then the water can go back to the heat pump and from there get heat up again. But also it's possible to use a thin carpet or even a wooden floor. The wooden floor must be certified though for underfloor heating purposes.
Okay, and would that include the laminate floors?
That can be done as well, yes.
Okay, righty.
Generally, it's not a big issue even with wooden floors or carpets. The temperature in the pipe, or the temperature of the water circulating in there, is around about 35, maximum of 40 degrees. That means on the underside, or on the upper side of the screed, on the underside of your final floor covering, you only have 28, 29, 30 degree.
Okay, so any material that can last at that temperature is a possible covering.
That is correct, which most of the materials do, because in summer the sun shines, the floor gets much warmer than what it becomes during underfloor heating.
Okay, before we move on, at this stage I want to just inquire, so what about expansion and contraction with the heating and the floor and all the water running through the floor, how is that catered for? Do we need to cater for that?
Yes. When we install the floor, before the polystyrene goes in, we cover all the surrounding walls in a wall edge insulation. So that it's a strip of also a flexible polystyrene which gets attached to the wall. And that basically keeps, when the screed is poured, that keeps the screed away from the wall. So there's always a gap between the screed and the wall, which means when the screed heats up from whatever temperature was poured, for instance 20 degree or 25 degree, to the final 35, 40 degree, then it can expand by 2 centimeters on each side.
Okay.
And that allows for the thermal expansion of it. Okay. So it's a floating, screed is floating in the room.
Okay, so and any expansion joints?
Expansion joints, yes. If the room gets very long, if it's a very long room, for instance, bigger than 12 meters, then we prefer to put an expansion joint somewhere in the middle to cut it into two blocks, pretty much.
Okay. Right, now I want to go a little bit and think laterally. Can the hydronics only be fitted to the floor, or do you have it any other place as well?
You mentioned earlier that the heat pump can cool as well as an add-on. The heat pumps I'm using, usually they have it built in. Either we use it or we don't.
Okay.
Now a problem with the floor is, if you cool through the floor, cold air is heavier than warm air, which means since we are cooling from underneath, that air doesn't convect upwards, so it gets stuck on the floor. Okay. Which means in the room, you're creating temperature layers. You're stratifying the air temperature from warm on top to cold at the bottom of the floor.
Okay.
In that case, it is better to cool from the top, which means using ceiling panels, for instance. It's the same method. It's a drywall panel where the pipe is laid in, and in summer you can cool. You circulate cool water through the panel, and then the cold air will fall naturally through natural convection and flood the room. If you do it through the floor, you can install, for instance, a small fan just to get a little bit of circulation.
Okay, so does that mean the ideal would then be that for your heating, you place that in the floor, and for your cooling, you place that in the ceiling?
Yes, that is correct. I mentioned earlier those manifolds. We can add a couple of more circuits on that manifold and then have, let's say, 5 circuits for that room supplying only cold water in summer then to the ceiling panels. Alternatively, also a very nice feature would be the wall heating and cooling. So if you transfer heat through the wall, it's always efficient.
Is this instead of the floor?
That can be instead of the floor, as long as the floor is insulated.
Okay.
So the floor must be insulated, otherwise you're going to lose
for the
lots of
heat.
And then you just heat the walls around you. You have to cover around about 60% of the floor area on the wall.
Okay.
Up to a height of 2 meters.
Okay.
And that gives you an idea how big that wall heating area needs to be.
Okay.
And that can be used then for heating and cooling very efficiently, because you're surrounding your body with either warmth, low temperature warmth in winter, and cold in summer.
Okay.
So your body radiates either in summer into the wall to get rid of heat, or you absorb heat from the wall.
Okay, right. And how difficult is that? That means it's a panel that goes on top of the wall, or do you place the piping and then you plaster the wall?
Yes, there are two options. If you build new, then the pipe is plastered. It's basically a rail which gets attached to the bricks. In that rail, we run the piping like a snake. And then on top of the piping, we'll have to have around about 20 millimeters of plaster covering.
Okay.
Which means the plaster will be around about 35 to 40 millimeters in thickness in total, counted from the brick wall.
Right. Does that mean the piping in the wall, those rails that you mentioned, would those now be the same PEX, or is it a different product altogether?
The rails is just to hold the pipe.
Okay.
The pipe is the very same pipe which we use in the floor, that multi-layer PEX pipe.
Okay.
But just to hold it on the wall, we use those rails.
Instead of those plastic, what did you call it?
Those knobs. Yeah. Instead of that knobs panel, which is laid on the floor.
And of course, the plasterer will have to know exactly what they are doing while they are plastering over this pipe network, and to ensure that the plastering won't crack.
Yes, it's plastered in two stages. The first layer is just to cover the pipe by 5 millimeters roughly.
Okay.
And then while the plaster is wet, we attach it's a web, like a mesh. It's a mesh.
Okay. Okay.
And that mesh will then be worked into the plaster.
Okay.
And then afterwards, you can add another centimeter of plaster on top of it, and that keeps the plaster strong.
Okay. And for that process, do you also need the house to be dust proof and a sealed envelope while you are doing this? It doesn't sound like it.
No, that is not as critical. It's really just about that floor piping, so that it can't get punctured. If the pipe is attached to the wall, it's unlikely that it gets punctured through walking over it or whatever.
And then you can just have a regular floor with a regular thickness screed and with carpet or whatever you want to do.
That is correct, but it must be insulated underneath.
Okay, that's fair
enough. Not to lose all the heat.
Okay, that's fair enough. Right, so if you now look at all these options, hydronics in the floor or in the wall for heating and cooling, or in the ceiling for cooling and heating in the floor with hydronics, this sounds very complicated as to how to choose which of these should be done, and the costs, it sounds as if it's too complicated to even try and figure out, but I'm sure you're going to help us with the costs, comparatively speaking. Istvan, and is some of this for existing housing? In other words, to easily retrofit hydronics instead of building new? How does all of that come into play?
The methods I just explained with regards to the floor heating or cooling and the wall heating are for new houses.
Okay.
But we also have a retrofit panel. It's a fiber gypsum panel, which can be laid on top of your existing floor. The thickness of that panel is 20 millimeters. In there, we also run that piping, that multi-layer PEX pipe, but it's thinner. Instead of 16 millimeters, it's only 11.7. So it will raise your floor by about 20 millimeters in total, but right on top of that panel, you can put new tiles.
Okay.
You will have to cut doors, though. And generally, you will live about 20 millimeters higher afterwards.
Yes.
But it is possible. Okay. Alternatively, we also have a similar panel, which is then attached to the wall instead.
Okay.
And in there runs the piping. It's a drywall panel, pretty much, and with cutouts, and in there runs the piping as an upgrade to an existing house.
Okay, so you've got the two options. We can take a conventional house and retrofit it relatively easily, or for a new house you've got the different options. And cost wise, how do the costs compare?
Of course, if you build new, it's always cheaper because you can plan everything right from the beginning. You can have your supply piping, you can lay it while they're casting the concrete and so on. If it has to be installed afterwards, it's always a bit more of a mission to find a loophole back into the building to install the manifold somewhere in the building. So it's always cheaper to build from scratch, new. Costs for such a system, you're looking at about 1,500 rand per square meter if it's just heating, roughly. If it is a retrofit application, so with those panels, then it's more in the region of 2,000 rand per square meter.
Okay, and when you say now the 1,500 per square meter, is that for your wall system or your floor or your ceiling? just help me understand.
That would be that for a typical flow installation.
Okay. Okay.
What I usually also do is adding some wall heating in bathrooms.
Okay. Oh, that would be nice.
If it is a badly insulated house.
Okay.
Because generally in bathrooms there's very little floor area available for the heat exchange.
Okay.
So I try to cover as much as possible in the bathroom, even under the shower, under the toilet.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but sometimes it's not enough, and then I add some additional square meters on the wall just to get that higher temperature. I mean, in the bathroom, you want 24 degrees ideally,
okay,
while in other living areas, only 20, 22 degrees.
Okay, sure. That sounds very interesting. Now, in terms of the wall heating and cooling, or for that matter, the ceiling, which can be in a newly built house, how does that compare in price per square meter? And how do you work the square meter? Is it floor square meter or wall square meter?
The wall square meter is cheaper because there we don't put polystyrene underneath, no vapor barrier, no knobs.
Oh, okay.
So the whole installation is also much quicker.
Yes.
Because it's really just a matter of attaching those rails on the wall and then running the pipe in there and then getting the pipe, the inlet and the outlet back to the manifold from where it's going back to the heat pump.
Okay.
The floor insulation is a bit more complex. All those polystyrene boards need to be cut into shape, into sizes, and make sure there's no hollow areas underneath, because that's going to create a drum effect when you walk.
Okay.
So it's a bit more complex to do a floor installation. A house only with wall heating I haven't done yet.
Okay.
So mostly it's floor heating and then added wall heating
In certain areas.
Yeah.
Okay, I understand. Yeah. Okay, righto. Right, so far, some of this is easy to understand, some of this is complicated to understand, and I'm glad that I'm not doing the installation, but that an expert is doing the installation. And then what can you tell us about other features that the system provides?
We talked about the cooling and the heating.
Yeah.
Which is powered by the heat pump.
Okay.
For an additional cost and with a little bit more effort, one can add pool heating as well. So if in summer the heat pump is not used for heating, then why not heat the pool?
Okay, of course. So in other words, the heat pump will just work a little bit harder and then also warm up the pool.
I wouldn't say it works harder.
Longer?
It works longer, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this way you can save one heat pump for heating the pool. The heat pump in summer is off usually for heating, and then why not use it for pool heating and have a nice warm bath?
Okay. Okay. Even in summer? To heat the pool?
You can heat, many people heat the pool in summer even.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a winter thing. Okay.
Well, in winter I wouldn't heat the pool anyways because the losses are too high and the heat pump won't be able to keep up. It's a waste. We want to be green, we want to be efficient, and heating a pool in winter is just a waste.
Okay, so for pool heating in winter, better use the method where you've got the something lying on the roof that'll cycle the sun's heat into the pool.
Those panels are very cheap.
Okay.
If the pool pump is running, then those panels will heat somewhat.
Okay.
Whether they can make up for the losses at night, that is another question. I think it's just a matter of how many panels you got on the roof.
Okay. Okay.
And for instance, in between. Winter and summer, that time when the sun is not strong enough to heat the pool yet,
that's
you can
a good
add
time.
The heat pump
that's a
as
good
an additional time. Source.
I understand.
But also here again, ideally the pool walls are insulated towards the ground.
Oh.
Water is a very good heat storage,
okay.
But it also conducts heat very well away.
Okay.
And the walls insulated and as well a pool cover should be installed just to lower the losses at night.
So to include the hydronics or the heat pump for the pool, you would have to, as you said now, insulate the pool. That means it should be part of the ground up building of the pool included in the design. Did I understand
correctly? Yes, that should be included in the design already. So if the client is interested in pool heating, okay, via that same heat pump, then I also give recommendations of what to do, how to make the system more efficient.
Understood. Okay. Any other features that the system provides?
Yes, of course. The heat pump in underflow heating mode is producing a water temperature of a maximum of 40 degrees. Now, this temperature can be increased, so the heat pump can produce a much higher temperature than 40 degrees. We just limited it there.
Okay.
Because anything higher than 40 degrees, maybe 45 degrees also possible, but anything higher than that is getting uncomfortable even.
Okay.
If you walk around in the house and the floor is too warm, then it's not very comfortable, not healthy as well.
Okay. Okay.
So in other words, the heat pump can produce hot water for domestic purposes. And how that works is, instead of heating the water in the floor, it switches over via a valve and heats a tank. That tank gets heated up to 55 degrees roughly, and then it's only a storage for thermal energy. Then from the tank via a freshwater module, we produce domestic hot water on demand. So only when the hot water tap is opened, the unit switches on, draws water from the tank, from the top of the tank where it's the hottest, draws that water through a plate heat exchanger, and on the other side the cold municipal water is connected, and as the cold water flows through the heat exchanger, it heats up to a set temperature, which is 40-45 degrees, which is more than enough for hot water already if you produce it on demand.
Okay, is this hot water now for the tap, for the kitchen, for the shower, for the bath?
Yes, that is correct. Okay. That unit is like an instant gas heater.
Okay.
When you open the hot water tap, the gas heater switches on and produces your hot water. The same way this unit is working, only the heat comes from the water which is stored in the tank.
Okay, which was heated by the heat pump.
Yes, and okay. The advantage of that as well is, since we are not storing huge amounts of domestic water, consumable water, right, the temperature doesn't need to be that high. In a geyser, the temperature is only set to 60 degrees because of the Legionella bacteria, which develops at temperatures lower than that.
Okay, from a health point of view.
Yes, okay. And since we are not storing any water, we are only producing it when it's really required, we can lower the temperature, and that makes it efficient again, more efficient.
Yeah, that sounds very complicated.
But what is required, since this is a central system, so the unit is somewhere outside, the tank is somewhere in the utility room, far away from any bathroom or kitchen, what is required is a so-called warm water ring network. And that is basically a pipe starting in the utility room, going to each and every tap in the house, and then coming back to that unit in the utility room. And following happens then, that unit can be programmed, for instance, in the morning before the owner of the house gets up, half an hour, we preheat the water in the ring. The same happens in the evening. We preheat the water before everyone gets home. And that means when you open the tap, it takes a second and the hot water is there already. So there's no waiting for the cold water to drain until the hot water gets to the tap. You save electricity, you save water.
Yes, yes.
You don't lose it.
Okay, especially the water that you save, if the hot water is hot almost on tap.
Yes, that is correct. Okay. It's really, from the drain, we only have 1 meter pipe, roughly, okay, maybe 1.5 meters, to the tap. And that is very, very little water. It's not even half a liter.
Okay, understood.
It's much less than that.
Right. Istvan, if you just give me a moment, I would like to just continue. But before we continue, okay, there we are. Right, everything is under control. I'd like now to just... And what are there any other features that your system provides?
Yes, all my systems come with an automation system. So that system is a PLC, a programmable logic controller, which I use to switch the heat pump on, to switch the heat pump into heating, into cooling, to tell the heat pump which temperature to produce, for instance, to switch the pumps on, which circulate the water to the manifolds, for instance, to control the valves on the manifold, to open the flow of water to the different zones. With that system, I measure temperatures in each room or each zone via sensors. So in the room, there's no panel or anything. There's really just a sensor that's a little box, usually mounted next to the light switch. And the owner of the system, he can use his phone and download an app. And on the app, he can see all the temperatures in each room. He can set the temperatures. He can switch from heating to cooling to pool heating. He can monitor the temperatures in the tank. He can change the schedule for the ring, warm water ring circulation pump. So it's very interactive, very informative interface, and that system gives me basically the possibility to monitor also remotely if there's a breakdown or anything. Then I can see what's happening, what are the temperatures, what is going on. It doesn't matter whether I'm in the office or at the client or sitting in Europe in a cafe.
Okay, now if I, as the user of this equipment, do I need to be an engineer? Do I need to be a programmer? How easy is it for me to use this automation that you are referring to?
It is very, very easy. Actually, as a owner of a system, you don't have to interfere at all. You tell me which temperatures you want in the room. I can set them for you. You can always change them afterwards, but after that, the system is self-sufficient. It controls itself. It's intelligent.
Okay.
It knows when it's summer. It knows when it's winter. It knows what to do at which point in time, and there's no need to interfere afterwards.
Okay.
One can, but it's not necessary.
Okay, understood. Thank you. Thank you for that interesting information. Anything else before I move on to the next topic?
That automation system is a very, very big topic, but that will be part of another conversation.
Okay.
A few weeks down the line.
Okay, so we'll have...
I'm very excited about it as well.
Okay.
It's actually one of my hobbies to fiddle with it, to program it, to try new things and new methods. So it's very, very interesting.
Okay, right. I can also share some information of how that automation helped us save money in the beginning phases after we built the greenhouse. So now let's go on to the... So we're going to have the presence for another discussion, and we're looking forward to that, István.
Yes, I will be back.
Okay. Now, what is an automation system? You've sort of discussed it broadly speaking. Is there anything else, or can I move on? And just with the idea that we'll see you again for the next discussion.
I'd just like to add that that automation system is expandable. I use it for just the heating part, heating and hot water and cooling part. But it is expandable, and if one considers future expansion of the house, one could add, for instance, a rainwater system and then monitor the level of the water through that same app, pretty much. Or install a photovoltaic system which generates electricity for the house, which can be used by the heat pump as well. And then that enables me, as the programmer, to switch the heat pump on if there's surplus energy available, which there is usually during the day. Overheat the screed by a degree or two, store some additional thermal energy in this grid, and therefore then have less runtime later on in the evening off ESCOM.
Okay, that's interesting.
So there are many things possible, but it's a huge topic, and I think we should move it to another.
Okay, we'll definitely session. Do that, and I'm looking forward to, and I'm sure the listeners are also looking forward to some more of your highly technical discussion, which I feel is easy enough to grasp, but it's not for the faint-hearted, I would say. Or is it?
Yes. I'm not sure how to answer, because I mean, I'm involved in this, and sometimes I forget that people might have never heard about underflow heating or these kind of automation technologies, and then I always have to go a step back and start explaining. But it's not a problem.
In the next interview, we'll have a look and a listen to that. So that was our discussion with István Nuell from Kajasol Green Building Solutions, talking about sustainable and green building design. Please take note that where we interview or run adverts, the content is not necessarily endorsed by Radio Live Green Smart. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and now over to the music.